This is Social Science Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
Social Science Bites is a series of interviews with leading social scientists made in association with SAGE.
Doreen Massey has made her reputation by studying space. Not outer space, space here on planet Earth. Professor Massey is a geographer who wants us to rethink many of our assumptions about space, including the assumption that it is simply something we pass through. She believes that an analysis of spatial relations between, for example, people, cities, jobs, is key to an understanding of politics and power.
Doreen Massey, welcome to Social Science Bites.
Hello, thank you.
The topic we're going to focus on is space. Now, some people might think that's a topic for physicists or architects. Why is it a topic for geographers?
I think the immediate way to respond is that if history is about time, geography is about space. What I do in geography is not space meaning outer space or space meaning atomic space or any of that. It is space as that dimension of the world in which we live, whereas historians concentrate on the temporal dimension, how things change over time. What geographers concentrate on is the way in which things are arranged, we would often say geographically, I'm here saying, over space.
So in your own work about space, what do you focus on?
Right, well, one of the things, in a sense, was anger. I got really annoyed with the rest of the social sciences and indeed with philosophers paying so much attention to time. And space became a kind of residual dimension. It's always time and space. So time is the dimension of change and of dynamism and of the life we live and all the rest of it. And space became the dimension that wasn't all of that. And a lot of us, I think, implicitly think of space as a kind of flat surface out there. We cross space. And space is therefore devoid of temporality. It is without time. It's without dynamism. It's a kind of flat, inert given. Foucault wrote in the later part of his life that, yeah, he thought we'd often been thinking of space like that, and that was wrong. Well, I agree with Foucault in that later moment. A lot of what I've been trying to do over the all too many years when I've been writing about space is to bring space alive, to dynamise it and to make it relevant, to emphasise how important space is in the lives in which we live and in the organisation of the societies in which we live. Most obviously, I would say, space is not a flat surface across which we walk. Raymond Williams talked about this. You're taking a train across the landscape. You're not travelling across a dead, flat surface that is space. You're cutting across a myriad of stories going on. So instead of space being this flat surface, it's like a pincushion of a million stories. If you stop at any point in that walk, there will be a house with a story. Raymond Williams spoke about looking out of the train window and there was this woman clearing the grate. And he speeds on. And forever, in his mind, she's stuck in that moment. But actually, of course, that woman is in the middle of doing something. It's a story. Maybe she's going away tomorrow to see a sister, but really, before she goes, she really must clean that grate out because she's been meaning to do it for ages. So I want to see space as a cut through the myriad stories in which we are all living at any one moment. Space and time become intimately connected.
If space isn't just an empty stage that's somehow inhabited, it's imbued with all kinds of stories and memories and events, how can you study it?
And there's a million ways to answer that, but I think one way is to say that it raises some of the most acute questions. If time is the dimension in which things happen one after the other, it's the dimension of succession, then space is the dimension of things being existing at the same time, of simultaneity. It's the dimension of multiplicity. We're sitting here and it's somewhere around midday in London. Well, at this moment, it's already night in the Far East. My friends in Latin America are probably just stirring and thinking about getting up. And space is that cut across all of those dimensions. Now, what that means is that space is the dimension that presents us with the existence of the other. Space is the dimension of multiplicity. It presents me with the existence of those friends in Latin America. And that means it is space that presents us with the question of the social, and it presents us with the most fundamental of political questions, which is how are we going to live together?
So would it be fair to summarise that as you are saying that space isn't about physical locality so much as relations between human beings.
Exactly. I mean, we don't think of time as being material. Time is ethereal and virtual and without materiality, whereas space is material. It is the land out there. But there's a dimension of space which is equally abstract and just a dimension. So that's the way in which I want to think about it. Space concerns our relations with each other. And in fact, social space, I would say, is a product of our relations with each other, our connections with each other. So globalization, for instance, is a new geography constructed out of the relations we have with each other across the globe. And the most important thing that that raises, if we're really thinking socially, is that all those relations are going to be filled with power. So what we have is a geography which is, in a sense, a geography of power. The distribution of those relations mirrors the power relations within the society we have.
Could you give an example of that?
Well, look at the city in which we're sitting, London. The power relations that run out from here around the world, from that Square Mile and Canary Wharf, are extraordinary. London is a key node, if you like, within the globalisation that has taken place over the last 30 years, the financial globalisation, the dominance of finance within the organisation of the global economy. And London has been absolutely at the centre of that. Not just that some of the most powerful institutions are there, and they are, but also in the sense that it was there that a lot of this neoliberal economics within which we now live was imagined in the first place. And so London has been part of the export, the imagination in the first place, and then the export of that way of thinking around the world. So its power is more than economic, it's also political and ideological.
Now, you've given a description of power relations in the city, but how is that political?
Well, there's a number of ways in which I think that way of looking at globalisation can lead you into asking political questions, which is more what I want to do. I mean, one thing is it enables you, if you like, to map power relations. I mean, I'm not against power. Power is the ability to do things. What I do find that we should be critical of in the social sciences is the unequal distribution of power, power of some groups over others, power of some places over others. And so one might want to be critical, and indeed I am very critical, of the role of the City of London in its domination of economies and economic ideologies, if you like, around the rest of the world. So one way in is a kind of empirical descriptive way of saying, look, this power is in globalisation at the moment too unequally distributed. But there's another way which I think relates back to the very way in which we think about space. The way in which we look at globalisation at the moment, it turns space into time. For instance, we're often using a terminology of we are developed countries. The countries behind us, as it were, are developing, and then you've got underdeveloped countries. Now, what that does is to convert contemporaneous difference between those countries into a single linear history. It's saying that that country over there, let's say it's Argentina, a developing country, isn't a country at the same moment which is different, but it's a country which is following our historical path to become a developed country like us. So in a sense, we're denying the simultaneity, the multiplicity of space that I want to insist on, and turning all those differences into a single historical trajectory. Now, that has a lot of political effects. I mean, the most important one is that it says there is only one future, and that's being a developed country. Yeah? And so Argentina must follow the way we're going. Well, as it happens, Argentina right now does not want to follow the way we're going. There's a lot of alternatives in Latin America that are saying we don't want to be developed like you are developing. We want a different model which is more egalitarian, more communitarian, and so forth. But that way of turning space into time, turning geography into history, is a way of denying the possibility of doing something different. If we take space seriously as the dimension of multiplicity, then it opens up politics to the possibility of alternatives.
So what you're saying is there's almost a gestalt shift that you're trying to encourage by describing the world in a particular way that reveals to your readers and to the people who hear you a different way of understanding the same phenomena.
Absolutely. If we took space seriously as a dimension that we create through our relations, which are all full of power, and as a dimension which presents us with the multiplicity of the world, and refuse to align them all into one story of development, then we really reimagine the world in a different way. It presents us with different political questions. I think it opens up our minds.
You've criticised this notion of developing countries and underdeveloped countries and the implication that this is all in one trajectory towards developed countries on the model that we in the West have. What can you do to persuade those who believe in that story? I mean, how can you convince somebody who is in the grip of that ideology that they're wrong?
It's a problem that a lot of us have, isn't it? That people get trapped in imaginations. It's a question of challenging common sense. And the hegemonic common sense at the moment includes that notion that we're stuck with this. And my stuff about space is one of the arguments that I hope will help to break us out of this feeling that we can't do anything about it. Now, the way you do that is you do little things like this. I talk all over the place. I write. I go to and work with countries which are trying to do something different.
Is it just a case that each society wants to project its version of reality onto the rest of the world?
Yes, I'm not wanting to attribute nefarious kind of intentions to people. I think I'd say two things. One is that that way of thinking, one road, if you like, is very classic to modernism and modernity generally, on left and right of the political spectrum. That there is a thing called development. There is a thing, one thing called progress. It's what we have called grand narratives. It was true of some versions of Marxism too, that from feudalism we would go to capitalism, to socialism and to communism. But it's also highly political and very much a product of power relations. There is no doubt that the banks in the city and the leaders of the Western world want the rest of the world precisely to follow and to be dominated by our model of the world. I mean, the USA and the UK are involved in absolutely trying to force other countries into what they call democracy, which usually means market societies. So there's both an overall zeitgeist, which I think is 100 years old, and which in the social sciences we have criticised a lot, the whole critique of grand narratives, and there is a particular political dimension in which the powerful do want to dragoon the rest into following their path.
Are there other ways in which space and politics link together?
There's loads of ways. For instance, Occupy. Do you remember Occupy London, that group of tents? I got a little bit involved. In fact, I gave a couple of lectures in the university tent. And what struck me very strongly was how spatial their politics was. For one thing, there was a huddle, a very unpretentious, low huddle of tents between vast stone edifices of God and Mammon on each side of it. And almost the very unpretentiousness of those tents were an affront to the pretentiousness of St. Paul's and the London Stock Exchange. The very physicality of that raised an impertinent finger to the complacent spaces of the establishment and neoliberalism. So there was something really symbolic, I thought, about the very placing of the thing itself and its material form. And even though it was so, so tiny, I think that's the reason it had to go. Somehow, in its very presence, it was asking questions that were too deep to ask.
Occupy, even by its name, was about space as well. It's really interesting the way they chose the word to occupy space.
That's right. And what I think they did was to create a new kind of space. One of the things that neoliberalism, if one can use that awful word, has done to our cities is to privatise a lot of what was public space. And that's one of the things the Occupy people and lots of other people have complained about. And of course, they tried to set up the camp outside the exchange and were told they couldn't because that square is, in fact, though you would not know from looking at it, private space. Now, the place where they eventually set up their camps was, in a sense, public space, in the sense that it wasn't private. People pass through every day and all the rest of it. But that's public space in a very loose sense of the word. What I think Occupy did, and which fascinated me, was to create public space in a more meaningful sense, because they created a space where people didn't just pass by each other on the way to work or shops or whatever. They talked, they conversed, they argued. There was argument going on in the tent. There were people on the steps of St. Paul's arguing with each other. While I was there, people who had nothing to do with the occupation came up to me and asked questions and talked. And it seemed to me that what they managed briefly to create there was a really public space, which means it was a place for the creation of a public, of politically engaged subjects, if you like, of people who would talk to each other about the wider world. And it seemed to me that was a real creation of a space of the kind that we need a lot more of, that brings us together to talk and to argue about the kind of future world that we want. So it seems to me that they were inventive both in their location and in the kind of space that they created.
Do you think geography as a subject can be a catalyst for this kind of activity?
I think it can. I mean, a greater appreciation of geography and why it matters and why, in the end, space is utterly political seems to me to be very, very important. I mean, look at this country at the moment. There's a huge divide between the north and the south of the country. OK, everybody knows that. What I would argue is that that matters. It changes the society in which we live. There are different cultures between north and south. There are different politics between north and south. But even more, it makes the inequality between the different people in this country even worse. So people in the south who happen to own houses are making money hand over fist far more than they're making from their jobs just by the rise in the price of their houses. My friends in Liverpool and Manchester aren't making that money. And so the very division between north and south is increasing the inequality between us. Geography matters. Or again, if you think about gender, I mean, that whole history of the division between private spaces and public places has been really crucial in the long history of gender difference between men and women and the confinement for centuries of women to private space and men being the public figures in the public space.
Geography is usually thought of as one of the social sciences. I wonder if you think of yourself as a social scientist.
I do, because that's the way in which I've worked within geography. And in fact, a lot of my life has been spent trying to urge the social scientists to take geography more seriously. Geography is a very multidisciplinary discipline in that sense. We do engage a lot with sociologists and with economists. But one of the things I like most about geography is the fact that it also includes people who are, if you like, natural scientists, people who study rivers and mountain formation and the Antarctic and. I think there is within geography the possibility of bringing together the social and the natural sciences more than we have historically done. And there are vast differences between them and the process is very hard. But we need to do that, I think, in an age which is faced by environmental problems such as we have, with climate change, with pollution questions, which are utterly social too. Then I do think the natural and the social sciences need to talk to each other more. And geography maybe is one of the places that could happen, and one of the reasons I love the discipline.
Doreen Massey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This podcast is made in association with SAGE. Transcripts of the interviews are available at www.socialsciencebites.com.